listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. Our next guest says that much of the water we see today, bodies of water that is, are not in their natural states. Not true wild rivers, creeks, streams, etc. That's because humans have altered and engineered our world to control water. And it's time more of us accept the idea that water is ultimately going to do what it wants. She says that understanding what water wants is one of the keys to adapting to the excessive highs and lows of water that are being caused by climate change. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How connected do you feel to the water where you live? How do you observe or monitor it? Have you been impacted by a flood or a drought, or multiple floods or droughts? What about high lake levels? Have you made a big life change like moving away? Call 800-642-1234, that's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Erica Guise is an independent journalist and National Geographic explorer. She writes about water, climate change, plants, and animals for Scientific American, The New York Times, Nature, The Atlantic, and more. She also co-founded the environmental news startups Climate Confidential and This Week in Earth. Her latest book is called Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to start by talking about this concept of water not being free. You bring up the phrase free river and talk about the first time you saw one in Alaska. Could you tell us about that moment and why it was so impactful for you?
Yeah, I grew up in California, which is arguably the apex of water engineering. There's just so many dams and irrigation canals and aqueducts, and everything is very tightly controlled. And I was in Denali National Park in Alaska hiking with some friends, and we came to this river that was probably about 40 feet across and fairly fast moving. And we weren't going to be able to cross it. And I looked up the floodplain and it was braided, and there were strands of it that were sort of twining together and apart. And I realized that this is what a river is supposed to look like, not this very straight canal, which is certainly what I had experienced growing up in California. And I think people in a lot of places around the world, you know, the streams and creeks and rivers that they know are quite constrained like that.
That was something that was really interesting to me reading your book, that even things that I might think of as, oh, that's just a natural river, have actually been shaped and molded by humans over time. Can you talk about some of the more natural ways that water wants to move and does move that we might not expect or have forgotten about?
Yeah, I think so. One of the key ideas in my book is slow water. And all of the people in my book who are trying to do things a different way are looking to recreate or restore some of the natural slow phases of water. So think about wetlands and swamps and floodplains, something that people in the Midwest are very familiar with. High altitude meadows and mountains covered with forests that generate rain. These are all places where water in its natural state would be soaking into the ground. And a lot of important things happen when water and the ground interact. It prevents flooding because the ground is absorbing excess water. It supplies water to streams in the dry season because the underground system is very large and complex. And so water very slowly returns to the stream into the dry season. So there are many things like that. And what I think we don't realize is the extent to which we have eradicated these natural slow phases. So here's kind of a mind-blowing statistic. Since 1700, humans have erased 87% of the world's wetlands. So that is a vast, vast area that is no longer able to absorb water in its natural way. And so, when we pave on top of those, we fill them in, we plant on them, then the water just speeds off really quickly. So that causes flooding, and then it also causes drought later. So one of the big points in my book is, yes, climate change is causing these water extremes. It's bringing bigger rainstorms with more water, longer, more severe droughts, 20 years and counting in the US Southwest. But a significant part of these problems we're experiencing with water is our development decisions. So that's urban sprawl, it's industrial agriculture, and it's the concrete control-oriented ways that we've tried to manage water. So the good news about that is there's a lot we can do to change that, even separate from reducing emissions, which of course we also need to do.
One of the things that you wrote about, which is a factor that might actually make flooding worse when it happens rather than its intended purpose of controlling water, is the levee. Can you talk about the levee effect and the research that's going into that?
Yeah, I came across this really fascinating field of study called sociohydrology, and that is just what it sounds like. It's humans and water impact. So for a long time, hydrologists would measure flows in rivers and not really consider what humans were doing. But levees, in fact, have a significant effect on what happens to the water, because of course they're constraining the river and keeping it from its floodplain. So it's well known, even by experts who build levees, that the more levees you put up, the higher the water will be. In fact, flood levels near St. Louis, Missouri, have increased up to 13 feet over the 20th century. And that's largely due to building of levees and restricting access to the floodplain. You know, the water can't spread out, so it just goes higher. It's kind of common sense. But the levee effect is a sociological impact where, you know, you build a levee and humans think, oh, this area is safe. It's protected. It's flooding less often. So more people move in there. They build their businesses and homes there. And levees, water people have a joke, which you may have heard. There are two kinds of levees, ones that have failed and ones that are going to fail. And there are reasons for that, which we can go into if we have time. But when you have all those people living in a floodplain behind a levee, they have this false sense of security. And then when the levee does fail, it's even more catastrophic because more people are at risk.
We're talking with Erica Guise right now, author of the new book, Water Always Wins. And Erica, in addition to the slow water movement today, you also go back in time and look for examples from the past, from the pre-industrial era. One of those that you return to in the book several times is the marsh dwellers in Iraq. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's such an interesting civilization. People have been living on top of the marshes in Mesopotamia, right? The Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, the cradle of civilization, for more than 9,000 years. You know, the ancient Sumerian civilization evolved out of the marsh dweller civilization about 6,000 years ago. And people today still live on top of the marshes. They use the reeds that grow there, Phragmites, which is invasive and kind of cursed elsewhere, but it's native there and it's incredibly fast growing and strong. They use it to build their homes, to build their animal paddocks, to build these islands that they live on that are on top of the marsh. And they really view the marsh as the source of all life, and they have a real caretaking attitude toward it. And it just kind of blew my mind, because in dominant culture, you know, we really think of wetlands as wastelands. And often what we try to do is fill them in and build on top of them, you know, make the land worthwhile or make it pay in some way. And yet here people have lived in harmony with wetlands, with marshes, for more than 9,000 years.
We're talking with journalist Erica Guise about her new book called Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How concerned are you about flooding or droughts where you live? If you live along the coasts here in Wisconsin, have you noticed a change in the water levels or erosion? If you farm, have you been impacted by flooding? How do you think we could do things differently here to account for what water wants to do? What planning would you like to see from the local or state government? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. for listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with journalist Erica Geis, author of the new book, Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. Also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you have an experience with flooding you want to share? Do you have questions about how water works and how we can learn to live with it? That's 800-642-1234. Erica, for your book, you spend time with a lot of hydrologists and water engineers, and that includes beavers. I want to talk about beavers. Can you tell us what they do to waterways and what we can learn from them?
Well, they're definitely the cutest water engineers, in my opinion. beavers are semi-aquatic rodents. They prefer to spend most of their time in the water because they feel safe there from predators. And to do that, to have more area in which to harvest food and move around, they build dams, which create ponds. And of course, ponds are a great example of slow water. And there's been some interesting studies about how much water they're moving underground and storing and what impact that can have, how that correlates to a city's water supply, et cetera. And it's more important with climate change, especially in places that rely on mountain snow for water, because there's less of that now. So if you can instead capture that winter water, if the beavers can capture it and move it underground, then again, it will continue to supply natural hydrology, natural streams in the dry season. And the thing about beavers is they can address both flooding and drought. In England, they have a lot of old towns built right along rivers, and they have had a lot of terrible floods across the country in recent years. And beavers were completely eradicated, killed about 400 years ago there. And so now people have brought beavers back in, and they are documenting, researchers are measuring how much it delays the water flow to prevent flooding. So it's kind of like flattening the curve in the coronavirus pandemic, where you want to, you know, try to not get it, and so you don't overload the hospital all at once. And similarly, the beaver slows the water. So it's still, the water is going out, but over a longer period of time to reduce flooding. And then in the Western US and Washington and elsewhere, they're trying to replace the snow storage with beaver storage to help weather droughts. And interestingly, beaver ponds are a really important fire break as well. Obviously, the water isn't going to burn, but they also raise the water table around the pond, which makes more water available to the plants. And so therefore, they're less desiccated and less likely to burn. And historically, beavers were all across the United States. And so it was a much wetter landscape than we think is natural. So if we can help the beaver continue their comeback from when we nearly killed them all, we'll have that resource for us in the Western U.S. where we desperately need more water on the land.
One of my favorite things in the book was a 1950 artistic rendering from the Idaho Fish and Game Service of beavers being parachuted in to mountainous regions to take place in a water restoration project that they were doing.
Yeah, it was so interesting. You know, people have actually realized that how beavers can heal natural water watersheds for at least 100 years. So starting in the 1920s, Idaho, California, they were reintroducing beavers from farming areas where they were getting in farmers' way to mountain areas where they could repair stream systems. And then people kind of forgot about it for a while. But yeah, the parachutes were because it was just after World War II, and some of the areas were so remote that there wasn't really road access to truck in the beavers. And so they tried parachuting them in quite successfully. In fact, there's only one beaver fatality from parachuting that I'm aware of. So it's an interesting experiment.
I want to go to our callers now. We have James in Reedsburg with us. Hi, James.
Hello. So I went to school for wildlife ecology in Stevens Point, and we talked a lot about wetlands and as well as the benefits beavers provide for an ecosystem. And wetlands, I mean, I kind of look at them as like the corals of the land. You know, they have such diverse ecosystems, down from the micro organisms that live there all the way up to the macro organisms. And they're great. They're nature's purifiers. I mean, the water that goes in there is dirt, you know, dirty and brown and can't see through it. And when it comes out, it's crystal clear. It's amazing to see that process.
James, thanks for the call.
I love
Erica, take it away.
Oh, sorry. I was just gonna say, I really love that analogy, the corals of the land. I'm gonna keep that one in mind.
Yeah, we don't have coral reefs here in Wisconsin, but we do have wetlands. And as James said, they have a cleansing effect on the water. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, slow water in its various guises is very important for cleaning water as well. And providing food, like, you know, he was kind of alluding to that with all of the biodiversity that can be found in wetlands. But that's true of floodplains, too. There have been some interesting studies in California with salmon showing that salmon who are allowed to spend time lingering on watery floodplains like they did historically are 12 times fatter. You know, they're better fed. And so they're much healthier and much more able to, you know, weather what comes. And we have this kind of like fish versus farmers debate. But in fact, that's a myth. Like fish and farmers can use the same water and be better for it. They're using it at different times of the year.
I want to talk about some of the ways we can adapt for the future and perhaps relocate, perhaps redesign. What are some of the ways that you're seeing communities do that, particularly here in the Midwest?
Yeah, I think one example that your listeners may be familiar with is Nahant Marsh in Illinois. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I'm a writer, not a speaker. Yeah, it's near Davenport, Illinois, and it's a wetland that they restored right near the urban area. And during the big 2019 floods, it absorbed as much as a trillion gallons of floodwater. And Davenport did eventually flood a little bit, but less than it would have otherwise. And, you know, the problem is, if you think about that 87% of wetlands that we've removed, you know, water needs a lot of space that it's not getting. So Davenport can do this marsh and they can have a small impact, but what's really needed are marsh restorations along the watershed so that every little bit can, you know, absorb some of it rather than raise the levels like the levee effect that we were talking about. And interestingly, like restoring wetlands on just 1.5% of a landscape can reduce the height and volume of flood peaks by as much as 29%. So it can be a really big bang for the buck. So that's a really great way to make space for water close to human settlements and within human settlements. And then, of course, in some cases, people are retreating from the river when they've flooded repeatedly. And the Midwest is actually the earliest example that I'm aware of this phenomenon in the United States. It's getting a lot of press now in coastal areas because of climate change and sea level rise. You know, there are many rivers in the Midwest, including, of course, the great Mississippi system and Missouri and Arkansas. And so people have dealt with flooding for a really long time and sometimes repeated flooding. If we have time for another story about Soldier Grove, Wisconsin.
Yeah, that seemed to be an instance where relocating a town actually made financial sense.
Yeah. So interestingly, some of these small towns decide together that they're going to move the whole town together. And usually this happens after a series of floods when people are just tired of rebuilding. And they, in the early 80s, they talked to the Army Corps of Engineers because they thought, well, maybe we need a levee to stop all this flooding. And the Army Corps said that it was going to cost $7 million, which was actually triple what the buildings downtown were worth. So they were kind of outraged by that, but also there would be additional ongoing bills forever for the long-term upkeep of the levee, and that would have bankrupted the town. So they collectively decided we're not doing that, and they all moved together.
Erica, in just our last minute or so, adapting to the way water naturally wants to move is going to take a shift, and it's going to take a bit of an ego check for humans in a way. How do you think we should start that shift in reframing the conversation?
Well, you know, the way we relate to water is not mandatory. There are many cultures around the world, including many indigenous cultures, that see water instead of as a commodity or a threat, as a friend or as a collaborator. And I think if you respect water, if we can respect water and understand all of the myriad things it's doing, understand its relationship with the underground, with microbes, with beavers, with humans, you know, we're doing this very kind of linear, single-minded problem solving when we build a dam or a levee. But if we're thinking in systems, if we're thinking of water with respect, asking what water wants, I think that's the shift that we need to live more peacefully and happily alongside water.
Well, we will leave it there. Erica, really interesting stuff. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Erica Guise is an independent journalist and National Geographic reporter. We talked with her today about her new book, Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. On the point of water movement, we got an email from Jeff who said, to those who are planning to attend the Farm Technology Days in Loyal, Wisconsin this week, the Wisconsin DNR has a booth with a pretty cool watershed model. Jeff says they're able to show the importance of stormwater management, specifically stormwater ponds, to help reduce peak flow rates. Looks like that event runs today until the 14th of July. Jeff, thanks for the heads up on that.